Our title tonight is Following Jesus, Is It Slavery or Is It Freedom? And you don't need me to tell you that freedom is a massive deal in our society. If we want to punish somebody, we deny them their freedom by locking them up in a cell. If adverts want to sell us something, no matter what it is, they give us an image of great freedom. We like our weekends, we like our holidays, because when we don't have to work, then we're free. And so freedom is a sweet, sweet word. Freedom of speech, freedom of artistic expression, freedom of association. Paul McCartney sang once, "We will fight for our right to live in freedom." Because we know that without freedom, we would have nothing. And so tonight's talk, I guess, is aimed at people who find themselves in some way or other wanting to hold themselves back from following Jesus. Maybe you're nervous of following him at all, or maybe you're just nervous of giving him your whole heart. And the thing that holds you back is the thing that is that you love your freedom, and you're afraid that following Jesus would in some way restrict your freedom and end your right to set your life's course. One of my mates at uni heard a lot about Jesus while we were studying together, but then he spent the next 15 years, you may find that hard to believe, but 15 years wrestling with the question of whether he himself would become a follower of Jesus. I met him for lunch once, and I asked him, I'd been quite patient, I think, but I asked him, "What has taken you so long?" And this was his answer. He said he found the integrity of his Christian family, the way that they lived their lives, to be incredibly compelling. And he found the truth claims of Christianity to be intellectually unavoidable, his words. But somehow, that knowledge of a good life and a true foundation for life didn't leave him wanting to become a Christian. And the reason was that throughout that time he was enjoying his life, he was popular, he was successful. And as he said it, his big fear was that if he were to make the decision to be a personal and a committed follower of Jesus Christ, it would be somehow like settling for second best on this earth. It would be to surrender his freedom. And I'm guessing that there'll be people like him here tonight. Most people believe that the devil throws the best parties. Consciously or not, they equate submitting to Jesus with a life of cardigans and slippers. Actually, I wrote that line before I saw that Hamish was wearing a cardigan this evening. But I want you all to know, you don't have to look like that if you were to be a Christian. So there you are, you're the captain of your soul, you're the pilot of your destiny. And the last thing you want is to move over and let someone else drive. You don't want to stop asking questions. You want to keep engaging your mind and your critical faculties. And submitting to Jesus sounds worse than boring, perhaps. Maybe you feel the sting of Jean-Paul Sartre's suggestion that following Jesus would be an act of betrayal against your whole being. That's the question we're tackling tonight. Following Jesus, is it a life of tyranny and slavery, or is it a life of glorious freedom? And the passage that we've just read is the perfect place to look for the Bible's answer to that question. It's all about freedom. And the good news is that we're not the only ones who want us to be free, because Jesus wants that for his hearers as well. But the surprise may come in where that freedom is to be found. I'm making just a couple of points tonight. And the first is this: people think that life without Jesus is freedom. Actually, it's slavery. So here in John's Gospel, as you look at verse 31, you'll see that Jesus is talking to some people who are starting to see who he is. They've been following him around for a little while, listening to some stuff, and so far they've liked what they've seen. But now Jesus is about to say something so controversial that by the end of the chapter, if you glance down to verse 59, they have picked up stones and are trying to kill him. Let me read again from verse 31. Jesus said to the Jews who had believed in him, "If you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." They answered him, "We're offspring of Abraham and have never been enslaved to anyone. How is it that you say you will become free?" Jesus answered them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who commits sin is a slave to sin. The slave does not remain in the house forever. The son remains forever. So if the son sets you free, you will be free indeed." So you'll see that the debate that's going on is about whether or not they're free. They think they are free already, but Jesus isn't so sure. And that means we need to work on our definitions. In particular, if I ask you the question, "Are you a free person?" I wonder what you'd say. The 18th century philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau famously said that mankind is born free, but we are everywhere in chains. But my experience of most people in the West, at least, is that we think we're pretty free in life, and the truth is we are. We're free to do as we please within the rule of law, at least. We're free to express whatever views we like, however repugnant. We're free to be whoever we like, wear whatever we like, to worship whichever God we like. And so it's a surprise when Jesus comes along in this passage and says, "Actually, you're wrong. You're not nearly as free as you think you are. In fact, you're slaves." That's not because of your external conditions, like Rousseau would say, because society has put up bars at your window. Rather, it's because there is a ball and chain inside your own heart. The crowd around Jesus, like us, think that they're free. But Jesus says in verse 34, everyone who commits a sin, everyone who practices sin, is a slave to sin. What he's saying is that you can have laws about freedom of speech, but they can't stop us from hurting each other with our words. And you can have bills about freedom of worship, but they haven't freed the world from religious hypocrisy. And even rich people covet their neighbor's possessions. And in places where people are safe on the streets, they still get hurt in love. And so freedom is hard to find. And Jesus says that's because we're not free. Everyone who practices sin is a slave to sin. Now, in the Bible, sin is defying God and his ways. It's making ourselves the author of the direction of our life, setting our own course for life. And the irony is that we tend to think that by ignoring God, we will become free. But here Jesus is saying that our God-defiance enslaves us. Because each time I defy God, I'm pulled further and further into defying him more. So that even if I wanted to stop, I couldn't. I remember when I was first thinking about Christianity, I used to think that I was basically in charge of my own actions, that I was morally free. So that if I wanted to do good, I did it. And if ever I was naughty, it was because I'd chosen to be. And so someone set me a challenge to try and prove that I wasn't quite as morally free as I wanted to think. This is what he said. "Okay, if you're free, just try and go 1 week without ever saying, thinking, or doing anything that is unkind or impure or untrue." He said, "Don't worry about a whole lifetime. Just go 1 week." And I thought, well, I am my own moral master. Of course I'll be able to do that if I put my mind to it. I want to suggest you give it a go. It's not nearly as easy as you think. I didn't last an hour. And you know, I still find that I want to be a good man in life. I want to be a good husband. I want to be a good father. I want to be patient and kind and selfless. I really do want those things. But I just keep mucking it up. And Jesus says everyone who commits a sin is a slave to sin. The captivity that he's talking about is not primarily a horizontal problem. that can be solved by a change of government or by the evolution of our social structures or by a better education. It is a vertical problem because as I defy God, so my defiance enslaves me. And if I were beginning to think, well, that may be true, but so what? Then Jesus would say, you should know that the consequences of being a slave to sin are absolutely fearful. So he says in verse 35 that a slave does not remain in the house forever. It's a slightly cryptic sentence in this translation, but the household or family that he's talking about is the family of God. And he's saying that left to our own devices, because we are slaves to sin, every single one of us is cut off from being a true member of God's household or family. And of course, if we're cut off from God's family, then we're cut off from God himself. And God is the source of all life and all beauty and everything that's good and true. And so you could say that we're living on borrowed time. It's like we're deep sea divers and someone has cut our oxygen pipe. And we might be okay for a bit living without God, but it is only a matter of time. The reality is that we're enslaved and condemned, and that if Jesus had never done anything about it, each one of us would be facing an eternity of his wrath. So there is the irony. I thought that being the captain of my soul would make me free, but actually it's just left me in chains to my own desires and a prisoner in the jail of God's judgment. Let me try and illustrate the point rather trivially. Let's say that back at your house you have a pet budgie and a pet snake. You're going to like this. Okay, so pet budgie, pet snake, and the budgie lives in the cage, but the snake enjoys the freedom of the carpet. And you're going away for a few days, and because you're that kind of person, you decide to give the snake a pep talk. So this is your pep talk. You say to him, snake, mi casa es tu casa, my house is your house. While I'm away, you are completely free. You can go wherever you like, you can do whatever you like, you can eat whatever you like, the drinks cabinet is yours, but just one thing, leave the budgie alone. But even before your wheels are rolling down the drive, the snake is chuntering to himself. What does he mean, leave the budgie alone? Who does he think that he is telling me how to live my life in this way? And so in the name of freedom, the snake hops up into the cage, swallows the budgie whole. Sorry, that's the sad bit of the story. Swallows the budgie whole and then turns around to leave the cage. Except, of course, and here is the moral, that by eating the budgie, he now can't get out because he's now so fat that he can't squeeze through the bars. And so eating the budgie, you'll see where I'm going, did not set him free, it imprisoned him. And Jesus says that is where we are. That rejecting the rule of God does not set us free. It leaves us in chains. And so what we desperately need is for someone to come along and set us free. So if the question is, will Jesus following Jesus in some way spoil my freedom? I want to say that actually our first mistake is to think that we're free in the first place. We're not. On our own, we're slaves to sin. Powerless to do anything about it. Because trying to live without sin is like trying to live without gravity. Just can't be done. First point today then, people think that life without Jesus is freedom, actually it's slavery. Here's the second, the opposite really. People think that life with Jesus is slavery, actually it's perfect freedom. So when I meet people who are thinking about being Christians, I sometimes try and ask them what they think that the Christian life would involve. What would it mean in practice for them if they were to follow Jesus? And I don't know how you'd answer the question, but they often say something like, it'd mean the end of my Sunday morning lie-ins because I'd have to get up and go to church, or it'd mean giving my money to charity, spending my spare time in prayer meetings and Bible studies. Worst of all, it would mean obeying this great list of thou shalt nots. And to many, all of that sounds like slavery. Well, if I can put it like this, if that's what you fear, that God wants some of your money and some of your time and to meddle with what you do on a night out and in bed, then you need to know that that is not what God wants. That actually God wants much, 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 much more from you than that. That he wants you. He wants the whole of you. He wants you heart, mind, body, and soul. There was a time when Jesus was asked, "Teacher, which is the most important commandment?" And he said, "It's this, that you shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your mind and with all of your soul and with all of your strength." You'll see, he wasn't talking about going to church and obeying some rules. He's talking about loving God with every fiber of your being, every moment of every day of your life. He's talking about my love and devotion. He wants to be the supreme love in my life above all other loves. And that is what it means to be a Christian. It means to value, to love Jesus more highly than any other person or experience or thing. It's about loving him more than I love even life itself. And so Jesus here is speaking about the surrender of my independence. And of course, that's the one thing we don't want to give up. If God wanted our time, we'd make some for him. If he wanted money, we could chuck a couple of quid into the plate. But God doesn't want my deeds. He wants me. He wants the control of my agenda. To which people will often say, well, what is God's problem? Why does he want everyone to worship him in this way? It sounds like he's got the ego of a crazed dictator. You may find this hard to believe, but when I was researching this talk, I was on Google and I discovered an organization called the Freedom From Religion Foundation. First of all, I thought it was the Freedom of Religion Foundation, but then when I clicked on the site, it became the Freedom From Religion Foundation. And they had this great little essay entitled, "What's Wrong with the Ten Commandments?" Let me read you a chunk. In essence, the first four commandments, by the way, are all about how you should love God before everything else and let him control your agenda. And they said, in essence, the first four commandments all scream that the Lord thy God has an uneasy vanity. How can anyone not perceive the pettiness, the bluster, the bombast, and the psychotic insecurity that lies behind the first four commandments? And my guess is we may not follow them on Twitter, but we do kind of know what they mean. Who does God think he is, wanting to control the agenda of my life in this way? And the answer is that he thinks he's God. Now, I've got no plans to do this, you'll be relieved to hear, but if I were to stand here today and say, I want all of you from this moment on to live for me, to put me at the center of your lives, to worship me, and to make me the supreme love in your existence, that would be an ugly thing, because there is no way in a million years that I am worthy of your worship. I have no right to be at the center of your life. But that is one of many differences between me and God. He really does have that right. He is your maker and your king. And so when he asks me to worship him, actually, he's just asking me to wake up to reality. Lots of us live in a little fantasy world in which the thing at the center of my universe is me, or my ambition, or my family, or my relationship, or my career prospects, or whatever I choose to put there. But that's not reality. That's just fantasy. The reality is that God is at the center of the universe. And so to worship God is just to give him his due. And to us, sometimes that might sound like slavery. But the weird thing is, the Bible keeps calling that life freedom. Now, you may not know this. The first three words that God ever said to mankind back in the first book of the Bible were not "thou shalt not," but "you are free." Not "here's a great big list of do's and don'ts," but "you're free to live within my parameters for life, to live life as the way that I intended it to be, live life as it best can be." That comes in our passage again tonight. Jesus says, "If you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." In sentence 35 there, he says, if the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed. One of the later writers in the New Testament, "It is for freedom that Christ has set you free." And it may be that the sums don't add up. How can total surrender to Jesus equal total freedom? And the answer is all to do with what we are made for. Let's say you get a summer job at some stage and you decide to work as an animal rescuer. And so you're out there rescuing animals, and day one at work you find an eagle with its wing that's been caught in some barbed wire or something. And so you take it back to your bird sanctuary, you untangle the wire, you nurse the wounds, and when the eagle has regained its strength, you take it up to a high open place and you launch it back into its freedom. But if the next day you go to work and you come across a beached whale and you want to launch it back into its freedom, let me suggest you don't take it up onto a high open place and then try and launch it into its freedom. Because to answer the question, what is freedom, we need to know, what is something made for? What is the environment in which it thrives? And for the eagle, it's the wide open sky. For the whale, it's the deep blue sea. But what about for us? What is the purpose for which we were made? What is the environment in which we will thrive as human beings? And the Bible's answer to that question is that we were made to know God and to enjoy him forever. We weren't designed to be solitary beings living independent lives, not independent of other people and not independent of God. The environment in which we are most free is the one in which we know God as our King and we serve him gladly. I thrive when I acknowledge that the one who is at the center of the universe is not me, but God. I'm free when I worship him with all of my heart, mind, soul, and strength. In this passage, I'm free when I abide in Jesus' teaching, when it becomes the defining center of my life to do what he says. Then I am free. I'm free when I worship him with all of my heart, mind, and strength, because the purpose for which I was made is to know God and to enjoy him and his people and his world. That's what it means to be free. But you'll notice the problem is that we're enslaved by nature, because we've turned our back on that relationship as we were just thinking. It's like we've all fallen down a big hole and we can't dig ourselves out. No matter how much we try and do, we can't get out of the hole. We're still slaves. And we can't sort of give each other a leg up and get each other out, because you're a slave too, so you can't set me free and I can't set you free. And so the hole is just too deep. And if we're ever going to be free, therefore, we need someone to rescue us, someone who hasn't fallen down the hole, someone who can provide a solution from the outside. Listen again to that cryptic sentence of Jesus, number 35 there. "The slave does not remain in the house forever. The Son remains forever. So if the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed." He's saying we're slaves, that we have no right to a place in the household of God. But Jesus and he alone, it's been one of the big points of the first eight chapters of John's Gospel, is not a slave. He is the Son who has come from the Father in heaven. That is, he has a right to a place in the household of God. He has not fallen down the hole, and he has the right to give us a place in the family of God as well. And so if we were to go out tonight and we were to pull up our socks and grit our teeth and to try and turn over a new leaf and to try really hard to be Christian, well, that couldn't set us free. But Jesus can. And that is why his words here are so precious. Because the whole reason he came to earth was to dig us out of the big hole that we are in before God. He came to set us free, to forgive us, and to restore us to the relationship with God for which we were designed. And I have to say that my experience of trying to live as a Christian for the last however many years it is, 20-odd, is that it hasn't, in my experience, compromised my humanity. Rather, it's taught me what it means to be human. It hasn't made me feel like I've become a robot. Actually, it's helped me to be the person I was meant to be. This is life as it's meant to be, free to think, free to study, free to explore the sciences, free to create, free to feel, free to explore the arts, free to enjoy the world and care for it, free to love, and best of all, free to approach the maker of the universe as my father. A freedom that is granted to me that starts now and lasts for all eternity. And so the whole reason that Jesus came was to set people free. He came not to punish us, not to put us in prison, but to give us life and life to the full. Life as it was always meant to be, and it cost him. Turns out he had to pay for my freedom, as we've been thinking this evening. Not with money, but with his life. Jesus died to set me, a slave, free. So I want to suggest that it would be an odd thing to be suspicious of Jesus. It would be odd to think that he wants to manipulate me or exploit me or harm me. It would be odd to think that following him would be something that is bad for me, because the King on the cross wants to love me forever. He wants me to enjoy freedom, true life, and he wanted to give me that so much that he was willing to die to do so. Free from slavery to my own foolish desires, free from condemnation, free for life lived with Jesus and for God. And so all through the world and all down the centuries, you know, they've locked people up for being Christians in lots of different cultures all over the world. But those Christians have tended to say, if you read the books about them, with one voice, well, you can lock me up, but you can't take away my freedom. Because if the Son has set you free, then you are free indeed. Well, there we go. I'm done. It's nearly time for your questions. But would following Jesus restrict my freedom? Turns out, says Jesus, it would be the very start of it. Without it, without me, you are a slave. But with me, you become a child of God. And that's the very definition of what it means to be free. So just before you ask me some questions, here's my question for you. Do you want to be free? Do you want to know true freedom? True satisfaction? True joy? True peace? All of them are found, not by running away from Jesus, but by running towards him. Found by welcoming him into your life as your master and king. They're found by holding to his teaching. Because if the Son sets you free, you are free indeed. Great, well, we've got a couple of questions here, and as we've done each week, there's the opportunity to ask questions from the floor as well, so at no point do you want you to feel this is just a sort of managed thing from the front. If you'd like to respond to any of the questions that Paul answers, or in fact would like to raise some new ones, please feel free just to stick your hand up, even though it's an intimidating environment. And here's one to kick us off with. Yep. If Christians find freedom in Jesus, then why do they make so much of obeying his rules in the Old Testament? And I guess perhaps beyond that, you know, what part do those Old Testament laws play in the Christian life if it's so free? Yeah, good. That's a nice, easy question to start with. So thanks for. No, it's not. thank you very much for it. I think I'd just answer it from to leave the Old Testament just to one side for 1 second. I would just answer it from what Jesus says here. If you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. So that if the life for which I'm made is a life in which I know Jesus as my king, my boss, my Lord, then I want every single aspect of my life to be lived in a way that is pleasing to him. That's what it means to be free, is to obey him in all the minutiae of life. And so I want to listen to his word, including the Old Testament bit of the Bible, as it's been fulfilled by him. That's another story. But I want to listen to his word, to his teaching, to know what that freedom looks like in practice. Because what would be an odd thing to do would be to say, I recognize that Jesus is the king who's come to set me free. I recognize that he knows best what human life should look like. I recognize that he, if you like, wrote the instruction booklet for life, and now I'm going to completely disregard it. That would be an odd way to live.
I mean, that touches on a very big issue, as Paul's alluded to. So would anyone like to push or probe on that further by raising your hand and taking it on? No. I will continue offering that. You don't have to avail yourself of it, but don't feel embarrassed for my part. I'll keep asking if you'd like to chip in. Here's one. Christians talk about freedom. Is it not as enslaving to judge others who are not Christian or who practice immoral behavior?
Thank you. I'd love to know what stands behind that question. Doesn't it enslave us if we judge others who aren't Christian or who practice immoral behavior? I don't think it is my place as a Christian to judge others who are outside of the Christian faith. It's Jesus who tells people how they're meant to live, not me. So I hope what we will never do as a church is to stand up and preach morality to people. Our job is to stand up and tell people about Jesus. If they come to know Jesus, they will then want to live to please him, and we can help one another to do that. But whether passing comment on societal issues or trying to help other people to know how to live is in itself an enslaving thing. I'm not so sure. But in terms of the judgmentalism, I don't think it's my place. If my friends or family are living in a way that is not pleasing to Jesus, I think the moral aspects of their life that are not pleasing to him, to be honest, are pretty low down the list of the things that I want to talk to them about. First and foremost, I want to speak to them about the lordship of Jesus. Because even if they reform morally, they're still slaves to sin in a different way. They're still separated from God, still ultimately actually under his condemnation. And what they really need is Jesus, because he's the only one who can set them free. So no, I think being aware of the difference between right and wrong is a wonderful thing. That's not an enslaving thing, if that's what lies behind the question. But I don't think it's my place to preach morality. I may not have got the gist of what you were asking, so feel free to come back on that, or grab me afterwards if you want to. Yeah. Do you think that's about right?
Yeah, no, I think so. And I think, you know, worth adding that I guess that's why we saw it from the lips of Jesus himself tonight. We don't want to offer our own opinions on these things, but simply just say, what does Jesus himself say? And if you'd like to, if that's something that is intriguing for you or different, that there are these free copies of John's Gospel. It's just one of the eyewitness accounts of Jesus' life. They're available at the back or through on the way to coffee. We'd love you to take that away just to see what Jesus himself says on that question and a host of others. I think our commitment is just to, as Paul said, here is Jesus, and see what you make of him. And if you'd like to take one of those away, I'm sure either the friend who brought you or someone here from the church family, we'd love to go through those claims with you. Would anyone else like to push further on that? Either if that was your question or if that's opened up other avenues. No? Okay. And well, here's our last written question. It's a fairly lengthy one, so to do it justice, I shall read it out, and then we'll see what you make of it. There seems to be two strands in the Bible. The first one, seen in John 8:31, and which the talk we've just had follows, assumes that slavery is a horrible thing and freedom a good thing. It just turns common wisdom upside down. However, there is another way of looking at it, which you can see in the Bible, for example, in Romans 6, one of the other chapters in the New Testament, whereby the writer simply says everyone is a slave. And in fact, it's not a bad thing in itself. Therefore, slave perhaps simply means a servant. And the question is, who do you serve? And the answer in Romans, in that bit of the Bible, says that you are either a slave to sin or a slave to Jesus, to righteousness. Are these then two different ways of saying the same thing?
Yes. There you go. It's a great question. Thank you very much for it. So I suppose what I'm challenging is the idea that being a slave to Jesus is something that is restrictive or disempowering or dehumanizing or any impersonalizing, any other kind of word that you can say that sounds bad in that context. I'm saying actually it's a wonderful thing that it is the essence of freedom, because that is the life for which I was made. But so there are different ways of thinking about the Christian life. I can think of a relationship in which I know God as my Father and I'm his son. That's a wonderfully warm and relational way of thinking about it. Equally, Jesus is a Lord and I am his servant. And so the appeal of Romans 6 is to offer every single part of my body as an instrument in service and slavery to Jesus, as an instrument for righteousness, to do the right thing with everything that I am and everything that I have. And that is the life that is, on the one hand, you can call it slavery because I'm living under a master, but because he's such a good master, it's a wonderful, freeing and liberating life to live. But the question is right. All of us are serving something or someone. For all of us, there is an ultimate authority in our life, something that comes first or tops. And too often we go through life not really thinking about what that ultimate thing is. And much too often that ultimate thing is not Jesus. But so there are different ways of approaching the same question. Jesus is the only perfect master. Whatever else it is that you're serving, whatever else it is that you think is going to set you free, will ultimately let you down. You think that the perfect relationship is the essence of freedom. Sooner or later, he or she will let you down in some way or die. And then that ultimate relationship won't be there anymore. Won't set you free forever. Jesus can set us free forever. If I think academic success is the most important thing. So many of you have said to me, when you went through school, you were the cleverest person in your school, and it was wonderfully exciting. And now you come here and you discover that you're pretty average. I'm sure some of you are still the cleverest person here, but when you go on and do your further studies, you'll find that someone else is cleverer. And that kind of way of achieving self, what you thought was going to be freedom by being the cleverest person around, turns out it doesn't work because there are other people who are better. And it can just pull the rug out from under your feet. But only Jesus can set us perfectly free, not only within this life, but also who can give us perfect freedom in the face of death. Because he alone has dealt with our biggest problem, namely what God is going to make of us on the other side of the grave. He died to set us free from that condemnation so that we might know him forever. And that's why, if we've been saying anything over these last 6 weeks of tough questions, in different ways every week in responding to the questions that you folks have been asking and telling us are the big questions that are on your mind, the big thing we're saying over and over again is it's all about Jesus. He is the way and the truth and the life. You want answer to life's big questions? Go to him. You want an intellectually credible approach to life? Listen to him. You want an existentially satisfying approach to life? Listen to him. It's all about him. So we would love you to consider him. And as Hamish said, reading one of those accounts of the life of Jesus is a great way to do it. Your friends in the church have been studying John, most of them with us this semester. They're perfectly ready and equipped to go through one of the Gospels with you and to answer any questions that you've got about it.